Welcome to the Navigating Hollywood podcast. My name is Alan Wolf, and I'm a filmmaker, author, and game creator. Today, Ricky Staub and Dan Walser are joining us. Ricky is the writer and director of the Netflix movie Concrete Cowboy, and Dan is the movie's producer. They also run the Neighborhood Film Company, which hires formerly incarcerated people and gives them internships that help them transition to careers. Welcome, Ricky and Dan.
Thanks for having us.
Hey.
Thanks for being here. So, can you describe the kind of work that you do at the Neighborhood Film Company?
We're a production company, so you know, we started out and still do branded content, commercials, etc. Obviously, in the last couple of years, we've branched into the narrative space, especially with Concrete Cowboy. But, you know, we launched the company in 2011 with a mission to be able to hire adults returning home from incarceration to work full-time at our company. And that's what we do today.
And where did you first get that idea?
I mean, legitimately, everything to do with the faith journey I was on at the time. I was in Philadelphia working on a movie called The Last Airbender. I was Sam Mercer's assistant. He was the producer. I was living in a city that at the time was new to me, and I was outside of a lot of my normal, you know, bubble, so to speak. And when I was in high school, I had become a Christian, which meant nothing really more than I just felt guilty about all the same things I continued to do. And it wasn't really until I was in Philly where I started to ask myself, like, why do I tell people that I'm Christian? And it was really the first time that I decided whether this is really something I want to tell people, because my life didn't really feel that very influenced by my so-called faith. And so it was my first real reading of scripture that I found just a vast difference between the Jesus in the Bible and the Jesus that I saw preached in churches or lived out by other Christians. And what drew me most specifically is in Matthew 25, Jesus talks about how what you've done for the poor, the lost, you've done specifically to him, like that he's actually in the poor. I was like, all right, well, I'm going to go meet some poor people and see if Jesus is actually chilling there. There's a guy named Will that I met who was homeless, formerly incarcerated, and that was really the first relationship that enlightened me to what was really like just the base of a huge mountain of problems with our criminal justice system. Yeah, I was laying in bed one night and this whole vision for Neighborhood came to me, a much more fractured version than it is now. Obviously, Dan coming on was a huge player in making it a reality, but essentially, I had never filled out a resume in my life, yet I was making really good money working for a world-class producer. And I thought, well, if I could train someone to do my job as well as me, and no one ever had to fill out a application, so to speak, or had my recommendation, that could change their entire life and open up career opportunities. So yeah, that was really the seed. And then, you know, that was 10 years ago at this point, actually more than 10 years ago, because it was a couple of years before we started the company. So 12, 13 years ago, there was like an actual physical conviction, like a weight in my chest. The longer I decided not to do it, the heavier it like physically became. I feel as though I was forced to make the decision to quit my job and start the company. It's the only way I can describe it. Whether you think I'm crazy for describing it a little bit, doesn't matter. There wasn't like a moral or like altruistic decision. It was a genuine conviction where I saw a path, or at least had been given a vision for a path. And I knew if I didn't do it then in my 20s, I would totally wuss out if I got successful, and I would never do it later. So it needed to be the core DNA of this company that didn't have a name at the time, but this vision. So I never wanted to start a company. I'm not, you know, I'm innovative, I guess, storyteller, but I wasn't like trying to come up. I'm not, you know, inventing widgets and selling. Like, this was truly like a vision I had that I was like, okay, this could be a game changer if it's real.
How did it go from being a vision to reality?
One thing that was really important from the beginning is that we wanted the quality to be just as much of a core element to the company. So that's why we made it a for-profit company. We wanted people to recognize the work, one, so that the company could actually grow and provide more opportunity. But also we found that inviting someone, one of our apprentices, what we call them, into a company that is doing really, really good work has this incredible dignifying and rallying effect because they're being asked to add to that dynamic. There's no charity. There's no sense of it's compulsory or you're just shadowing and sitting on the sidelines. We wanted to invite them into a company that was known for its creativity and known for the quality of its work so that the opportunities that would come out of their experience would be that much more beneficial and more doors would open. You know, it was kind of a process of learning multiple parts of A, how we were running our production company, but also every year I feel like we learn new barriers for people that are re-entering society after being incarcerated. So, you know, it's a little bit of experimentation, certainly in the first few years, where every time we create one pathway to opportunity, we'd run into another barrier. And so, you know, a couple of huge things that really helped formulate the apprenticeship. One is that we started a really, really amazing partnership with these two federal judges in Philadelphia who run a reentry program. Essentially, these nonviolent drug offenders that are coming into their program right out of prison for a year off of their parole, they're a part of this program where every week they're in front of these judges talking about what they're doing to get their life together. And then they have a team of advocates essentially that are helping take away barriers for them. But one of the major things that they couldn't provide was opportunities at private companies because sadly, particularly at that point, there was huge reticence, as there still is, in private businesses to hire people that are formerly incarcerated. And so when we kind of showed up, they were like, this is amazing because we don't have pipelines to career opportunities. We might have job placement programs that put people in kind of like high turnover, low pay kind of basement positions, but we don't really have opportunities for them to like be invested in as though they're going to build a career and not just have a job. And so it was kind of a perfect marriage. They're incredible communicators, collaborators, incredible people. So that was a big thing because then, you know, all of our apprentices that have come through our company have come for the most part through that program. So that was a big part of it. And then I think just us learning every year what element needs to be added. You know, we've determined like what additional education is necessary, counseling, because, you know, a lot of these individuals, if not all of them, if they've been in our prison system, they have undergone trauma. The need for trauma-based therapy after they get out of prison, it's incredibly important and something that's separate from us as their employers. You know, we learned where the lines, the boundaries needed to be between being their bosses, but also holistically hoping for and pushing them towards like transformation.
When you explain what you're doing to people, what are the reactions that you typically get?
In the very beginning, when I was pitching the idea, people thought it would never work. It was not a great idea. I always like to talk about a meeting I had with some folks at Wharton School of Business that told me that someone who's formerly incarcerated would never be able to compete at the level that we're at. And then 3 years later, they had me come back and teach at their master's degree program. But then there was like some convincing, maybe some trepidation when clients would find out like that we had someone who's formerly incarcerated. That was less common than I thought. Actually, people were actually pretty gracious in terms of like clients, but many just didn't know. We don't put it out there front and center. It's, I mean, it's on our website. More people know about it now, but in the last couple of years, even just the tie with how many people of color are formerly incarcerated, the conversation has definitely changed where there's a lot more encouragement and support for what we're doing, well beyond I would have ever dreamed. What would typically happen is we'd get hired because of our work. And then at some point down the line, the clients would like see the TED talk I gave or like read an article and be like, wait a second, whoa, I didn't know idea you guys were doing this. And we'd get these really heartfelt emails.
It's also interesting because there's definitely been a societal shift. We're in a season of our country where common ground is very difficult to find. And I think what's interesting about the concern about our criminal justice system is it's become more of a bipartisan issue than it ever was before. I think people have a common, for the most part, common understanding of how broken the system is, even in terms of prevention, incarceration itself, and then reentry. I mean, obviously, we live in more in the reentry side of that journey. And so there's just a lot more goodwill towards any kind of advocacy, change, improvement, we think there's a long way to go, particularly in the area of like private businesses, because that could be an incredibly beautiful engine for opportunity for people coming out of incarceration. So there's a lot of work to do, but I feel like it's changed to where people are more often coming to us now asking, how did you implement this? Because they have an interest in doing it versus at the beginning, which is like, that'll never work. Don't call me again.
We're not actually doing anything magical. We're literally just giving opportunity to the right person. We do a really heavy lift on the interviewing side, and it's not charity work. We're recruiting. We're just recruiting out of people who are coming out of prison, but they're just as talented, just as motivated, and just as ready to work as, in some ways, way more than a college graduate who's partied and wasted 4 years not actually learning how to do what they need to do at my company because I got to train them anyway.
Well, yeah, and that's so a good thing to, yeah, we're always encouraged. It's like, it isn't magic, and really it's just a very intentional internship. And almost every company has internships, and you have to train new employees no matter what. No one comes out of college being like, yeah, I was, you know, my class schedule really got me ready for your law office. Like, yeah. No, like you have to show them and explain to them the DNA of your company and how it works. And if they're driven, focused, you know, they're going to succeed. Yeah.
There might be some hurdles for someone who's formerly incarcerated, like they don't have a safe place to call home, which we're addressing, or they don't have certain money, or they don't have a car, you know, but those things are solvable and shouldn't withhold someone from having a future.
When you started this production company, you did commercials, and then you built up to doing Concrete Cowboy. Can you describe the plot of the movie?
The narrative setup of it is a teenager who is getting into trouble in Detroit and living with his single mom. She's fed up, and she decides you need something to change in your life, and decides to drive him to Philadelphia, to the doorstep of his estranged father, who is essentially the leader of this community of black cowboys in North Philadelphia that have existed for over 100 years. And so it's really a coming of age story in the context of this wonderful community, but this kid who's really a fish out of water and learning A, about the community, but about his father for the first time.
Ricky, before that, had you mostly directed commercials? Is that what prepared you for this role?
Yeah, definitely. The commercials gave me the skill set as a director. When I first started the company, I was only producing. Dan and I had always been writing scripts on the side, but at this point I was writing creative for commercials. And it wasn't until, I want to say, 2014 or 15 that I first started just calling myself a director, because there were jobs that needed a director that no one wanted to do. They were the less cool jobs, as I call them, like the doctor shaking hands. But I own a business, and those commercials pay money. So I was like, well, I'm going to direct them then. And then I just really fell in love with it. And I just started hiring really great, talented people, DPs, that could teach me the difference between a wide lens and a long lens. And then I got my own camera and started, you know, getting my own eye and stuff like that. But it wasn't until we shot The Cage, a short film that we made that we put out in 2017, that I really felt like I was actually a director, which was more or less a way for me to prove to myself that I could direct, but for us, who had been writing for over a decade at that point, be like, do we have the actual, is our potential real? Can we actually tell a story that's longer than 60 seconds, actually involves true narrative development, character development, and actual acting? Because at that point, we didn't know. I think commercials were a great testing ground to learn the craft, but they're very different animals. I would say drastically different. Until we had made the short, that was really the start of what I would call as my directing and voice now, or our voice with storytellers even.
And The Cage was a very compelling, beautiful film. Was your hope in that film to create an allegory for what the people in your life were working through?
It started out actually as an idea for a promo for a friend of mine, Andre Wright, who runs a nonprofit in North Philly called Give and Go Athletics. Who he offers basketball camps as a form of, like, basically mental health behavioral therapy. The deeper, true under story is it was a lot of my own journey understanding who God is amidst suffering and pain. This idea that God is not surprised by our brokenness and that actually has plans to make it beautiful. A lot of that was something I learned going through my own personal traumas at the time and just seeing that, you know, this isn't something I was being punished for. It was the Lord was going to use it in a beautiful way, even though if I didn't see it yet.
And what were the traumas that you were working through at the time?
There was a lot of like betrayal I was going through with close friendships. Mm. There's a lot of hardships and with my brother's incarcerated. Been incarcerated since I was in college, which I've wrestled greatly through his treatment. It is a mixed bag of like my own personal trauma and just kind of looking out as you engage, as our company engages people who are coming through suffering, you start to ask questions of like, that everyone wants to use as an excuse not to believe in God is why would there be a God that allows suffering? And at least in our journeys, Dan has gone through his own load of suffering, which is part of what I think binds us together, is that there is the most beauty I've ever seen coming out of those trenches. So that film was really a testament to that.
Do you think that part of the vision of the film company that you created could have come out of knowing that there's hope for your brother?
It seems like it would be a likely tie, but my brother has severe mental illness, so it's totally different.
I think the hope is a huge part of it, though. I mean, I think if you do any digging or you make any effort to have a relationship with anyone who is incarcerated or was formerly incarcerated, you'll quickly find and be heartbroken by the reality that people who just need an opportunity, just need a real opportunity, don't get one. And they would absolutely take advantage of it and make something beautiful out of their careers and lives. And by the way, teach everyone around them some really incredible things in the process. That, I think, is the heartbreaking injustice that you feel in these situations. This is not the way it has to be. And I think that the hope that it can be different does drive us and has driven us from the beginning.
What were your hopes for Concrete Cowboy?
When we first got involved, there was a gentleman named Eric Miller, like the first black cowboy that we met, actually in court while we were talking about our apprenticeship. He was the one that really laid out the really nitty-gritty of what this community was facing, the larger black cowboy community in Philly, and that Fletcher Street was a representation of kind of like the last homestead there, and that he wanted to use this film as a way to help solidify their legacy in the city and keep it around because they were facing, even in 2017 when we met him, gentrification issues, which now 4 years later actually came to fruition. They lost their land 3 or 4 months ago. Right on the heels of the release of the film, ironically. So the goal of film is actually, you know, make a great film that people enjoy it, but also use it as a catalyst for change, which we're in the middle of now. You know, there are many groups in the city that are benefiting from the film's success. The group that was involved in the film was able to establish a nonprofit that we helped put together with them, and we, you know, raised over $100,000 and are working with the city. Hopefully the city comes through and actually delivers on their commitment to give them land to create a permanent home. So yeah, but we're in the middle of it right now. But that, you know, that was the mission, so to speak, behind that film and what really got us excited to make it. Besides just the obvious, which is black cowboys riding through the hood of North Philly is majestic and cinematically beautiful.
Yeah.
But there was a lot of heart to this community that over the years, getting to know them, we were drawn into more and more.
What's been surprising to you about the way the movie has been received?
On one end of the spectrum is people that absolutely love the film. I think particularly in Philadelphia, where the community is, I mean, the sense of like excitement and pride to the point of tears, like that they all have for the film. I think that's probably the greatest joy we get out of in terms of reactions to the film. I think you're always pleasantly surprised when someone sees layers in the film that you intended. I think that's always a joyful surprise. It's interesting for it to come out when it did. You know, I think we never intended necessarily to have a film that was specifically so joyful in many ways. And I think we, in some ways, I feel like that was something that was really amazing to see how the timing worked out, that I think we kind of needed a story that was ultimately uplifting. Obviously, there's difficult things that some of the characters are going through, but ultimately that they left you with a sense of joy. I was pleasantly surprised by how that met, you know, our audience at a time when they needed to see that.
Yeah, which you can't, you know, it's actually remiss in a conversation I had with Mr. Elba several months ago.
He makes you call him Mr. Elba.
Mr. Elba, with utmost respect.
Can't look him in the eye either.
He actually called me and was like just celebrating. He said, it's amazing. You know, when we started working on this film, this was 2017. Mm. And he's like, it's just incredible. You had no way, saying this to me, to predict how important this film is going to be for us in 2021. Mm. As a country, as a people group, like something that really just celebrated this community. And, you know, we were just kind of waxing poetic about how we did it. We pulled it off and, you know, was ready to go out into the world. And he was just so like proud and excited to be behind it. And it is, you know, I think the film, you know, had it come out 2 years prior, still would have been really beautifully well received, I hope. But it did come out at a time, like we got a lot of response that maybe it wasn't surprising, but it felt surprising of just how many people were like, God, I needed this so bad, just to be like reminded of
community.
Of community.
Everyone's feeling so isolated.
And just how, you know, the film was made with such a vast array of voices. You know, like there's more community members in that film than Hollywood actors, you know, but there was that time, that 4 months over the summer was truly like this cosmopolitan melting pot of people coming together to tell this story. The process of making it was actually one of the greatest testaments, I think, to unity that our country needs right now. Mm. So I have a lot of hope because I saw it happen in the corner of North Philly one summer, you know?
Yeah.
Wow. As the actors intermingled with the community, did the community realize who these actors were? Did they treat them like everyone else? Like, what did that look like?
Yeah, it was amazing. I mean, they didn't care at all that they were actors. I mean,
they knew who they were.
They knew who they were, yeah. Mm. I mean, I think the only one that I ever saw created some kind of starstruck reaction was Method Man, because I think for them, like, he came on the block just, and it was like pandemonium, but... You know, I think what's incredible about this community, they really don't care. Like, it doesn't matter who you are. If you come into this community, you're expected to, like, get up on a horse, to do your part, to, like, they're going to talk trash to you if you're not doing things right. And so in a really playful way, in a really, like, ingratiating way. And so it was really cool to see, you know, the hope in the approach of casting so many non-actors, real people from the community. All the background, all the extras were people from the real community. And the hope was that the Hollywood actors would be grounded into the world by working alongside the real community members. And then, you know, that went both ways, which is really cool, is that the real community members, the non-actors, their performances were lifted because of the help of the Hollywood actors who were just so generous with their time. I mean, Idris and Method Man, Lorraine, Jarrell, they became a part of the community. They were just there. They hung out in between takes. There was no separation of the worlds.
Yeah.
It was like an ongoing family barbecue with cameras, which had its own, you know,
had its own challenges.
From a producing standpoint, yeah, it was, had its own security.
Trying to get people
security
focused
issues.
Sometimes. They got a little too friendly as family. And I'm like, all right, guys.
Yeah.
Still going to make a movie.
I mean, the things that were yelled outside windows. That were yelled outside windows at Idris from women in North Philly.
Walking through North Philly with Idris Elba.
What were some of the biggest challenges in making the movie?
Unbelievably beautiful how it all came together, but making a film with the community, not about the community, had its own challenges from a producing standpoint. You know, even just logistically, like working with a majority of people who have never been on a film set, don't understand call sheets and call times and hair and makeup process and all the things. And then I think how many of the stunt doubles were real people?
11 of the 14.
So 11 of the 14 that were like the stunt.
This was a SAG show, so all these people got tapped hardly in SAG, trained,
made great money throughout the process.
Oh, a lot of money pumping through that neighborhood that summer.
But just, you know, even the dynamic of the hurry up and wait of a film shoot where we had, you know, a young kid who was cold stunt double, like a couple hours would pass and he would just get like bored and like roam off set somewhere and we'd have to like find him, you know, like stuff. And really no fault of his own, just didn't know. And so we would always laugh. It was like half producing, half like community organizing is really what it felt like. So that part was challenging, ultimately incredible, but that was challenging.
We knew it was going to be worth it. We knew it would be hard.
And some of the other things are pretty typical time. We only had 20 days to shoot it. I think two of those days, like half the days got rained out.
Three.
Oh, three. That's right. Yeah.
And I still had to shoot the same amount the same day.
So we had days where we shot 12 pages. I mean, like crazy fast.
Yeah, it was fun to like, you know, let's kick it to next week. But then it would rain. It's like our AD, Christo, would be like, you know, there's like cutoff. Like we don't get extra days. So
there's no next week.
There is no. After this week, there's no next week. Yeah, that's tough.
And it's funny that on your first film, you chose to work with animals too. Because the warning with directors is don't work with children or animals. And on your first outing, that's what you chose to do.
And lots of them. I mean, there were some scenes, like I think, I'm like, why are there so many horses? Why did we do this? Like, there's so many horses in this.
I mean, the irony is when we were writing the script, we were getting into pre-production, we're like, we had to cut a tremendous amount of the horse work just to make the 20 days.
Yeah, it was hard actually because they were like, I'm like, guys, there have to be some horse scenes. Like, people have to ride. Like, this is a cowboy movie. Contrary to what people believe, because Idris Elba was in it. And this other cast, like it was a low budget. It was a quick pace.
But yes, you're right. Funny didn't feel like the right word for it when we were going through it. It's like stupid or crazy was probably more
audacious. Correct. Ambitious.
Ambitious. Yeah.
That's what they said. This is an ambitious schedule, an ambitious script. Where you realize they thought
code words.
Code words.
Crazy. Yeah. Nice good singer. Yeah. Might fail.
Can you talk about what happened with E before production started?
So E was the cowboy that I mentioned that we met in court. He, you know, had been out a week when we met him and it's telling the judge that he bought a horse, which really perked our ears up at that point. We knew about the Fletcher Street Cowboys at that point because their stables are less than a mile from our office in Philly. Yeah, we, you know, struck up a conversation, which led to a friendship, which led to us collaborating with him and the other cowboy Mill, who actually plays Paris in the film. The two of them really stayed shoulder to shoulder with us for years leading up to putting the script together and getting it to pre-production. Unbeknownst to us, he had fallen back into drug dealing. And a week prior to our production office opening, he was murdered in his home. Yeah, it was really tough. It's still tough. I don't know if I've even fully mourned his loss because I was in LA. I flew to Philly to his funeral, and fly back, get my family, and 2 days later start on my first movie without the person who was going to literally escort me through the entire process with the community. But something that was really beautiful that happened over the course of that summer and it's still happening is particularly when I was at his funeral, I couldn't help but like ponder whether us making this movie was even a reality anymore without him, because he really was a leader there and this was his movie in so many ways as it was mine. But the amount of people that I met at his funeral who he had already talked to for years about how important they were going to be to making this movie, it was as if all the seeds he had planted were like coming, I was seeing the fruit of his work. Like just so many people coming up to me and like, we got to finish this for E. This was so important to him. I remember sitting with his sister in our office and her saying how much this was going to be the best thing he ever left his kids. And so it really was, there was a, you know, a handful of cowboys and cowgirls who no joke, showed up every single day to support me directing this. They were always behind camera, watching the monitor, throwing out lines for the Cowboys to say, or they'd say it like this, but that's not how you'd say it, or you don't sound like you're from Philly. You know, one of the Cowboys, Al, said, you know, we got to make sure you don't f*** it up. That's and he meant it with the most beautiful heart that, like, this was, he knew how important this story was to everyone, but most specifically to E. And in some poetic way, I think us losing E because, you know, he fell back on, you know, poor decision making, let's say, that him being a drug dealer isn't the legacy he's leaving with this film, you know, for his kids. That, to like steal a quote from Bryan Stevenson, it's, he's more than the worst thing he ever did. He genuinely was a really beautiful person. And yeah, there was a lot of tears that summer. It was a really, it's still a strange, I still don't even understand how I fully did it. There's a lot of heartache, but we made it through. And I think what we did, even with all the beautiful.
When that happened, did that bring up any questions for you to God?
No, I'd gotten all those out of my system through all my other deaths in my life. Sadly, Eric is not the first person I lost in my life. So I've exhausted that complaint. God is God because there's always going to be things we can't answer about his existence. If we could, then one of us could be God. And so I'm okay hanging in tension that there are going to be things that can't be answered that happen. Particularly, I always see it around suffering. No one seems to have a problem with miraculous, positive things happening. Someone can always take credit for that. But when there's negative or death or unexpected death or tragedy or suffering, we always want to blame someone or something. And God is the easiest target. But I think it's ultimately more of an excuse not to deal with the reality that we live in a world where people die every day and hurt every day. We can choose to ignore that or try to hide from it, or we can accept its reality and live into it. It doesn't make it easier. It doesn't make sense to me that Eric was murdered because of how just divine the whole process leading up to like actually getting a movie made was in this fashion. It's just so sad. You know, I mean, I still have my last text exchange with him because the morning he was killed, Lee Daniels posted on social media about the movie. And Eric doesn't have social media, so anytime I would like, dude, this is look, Lee Daniels is talking about your movie. And I could look it up, but he was like, yeah, I still got to go through the script with you. I still have some more changes. He's always wanted to make changes.
Make sure it was right.
Make sure it was right. So, yeah. It's probably something I will continue to find clarity on the rest of however long I have left.
It's amazing the dichotomy that we can live in with one amazing, glorious thing happening, and then simultaneously some really dark things were happening in his life too.
I hope people can learn that there's nuance in everything, you know, as we live in a polarized world where we like to think that there are good people and bad people. But there's not. There's just people who are all hurting and all broken. And that's just the truth.
Yeah. Well, Concrete Cowboy is rooted in the history of Black cowboys in Philadelphia with a majority Black cast. What would you say to someone who says, oh, well, should you be telling the story because you're white?
Yeah, I get that a lot.
So people have actually asked you that question.
Yeah, pretty much every interview I'm ever in or every person we ever go to pitch the movie to when you're trying to get it off the ground. Why you?
Wow, okay.
Yeah, I don't think that there's a quick and simple answer to it. I think a lot of what we just discussed is probably the answer to it. You know, like I, particularly when we started this company, it wasn't to tell Black stories. But when a majority of the people who are incarcerated are Black, and then those people are coming through our company, those relationships matter to us. And when I first became a quote-unquote storyteller as director, I looked around at what stories to tell with the people who were closest to me, and they happened to be Black. And, you know, prior to Hollywood knowing who I was, this community didn't question me as a storyteller, telling stories with them. You know, even if you ask the Cowboys today, I've been in some interviews where they're confused by the question, why wouldn't we trust Ricky? He's down there with us. I don't want to say that it's a manufactured dilemma, but in some ways, there are certain people that I think, because of the color of their skin, they may not be an appropriate fit to tell a story. But I don't actually subscribe that you have to be the same race as the lead character to tell that story. Something that was so beautiful about this process is that I obviously did not grow up a Black cowboy, but to be invited into this community and to what it taught me in terms of empathy and compassion and understanding for people who aren't anywhere near me has changed me into a more sensitive, empowered person for that community. And I think, and I hope that that is actually the goal, is to see healing. And I also think that there's just a disingenuous amount of priority put on the director. Like, if you watch Concrete Cowboy, I didn't do that. It's not a film by me. That community was behind the camera, in front of the camera, all over the camera. Like, I was just one, an important part of it, but I was just one player in that. And the whole cast, you know, it's everyone. That this film in particular really is everyone's film, because everyone, without their involvement, it wouldn't be the same. You know, I was help shepherding it in a lot of ways, but I don't know if there will ever be a story I tell that is an exact replica of my life. I don't know if that's a reality for any filmmaker. So it's a lot of ways I think it needs to be handled with nuance. But I understand that there will be people that just don't approve of me doing it because of the color of my skin. But I can't make everyone happy. But I do know that as it relates to this specific film, something really beautiful took place. And well past the film's existence, these relationships with Black Cowgirls are going to exist in my life probably till I'm gone. And so that to me is something really special and beautiful.
Just you saying you can't make everyone happy, great life lesson. And just hearing everything that you've been through, it seems like you were the one who was most prepared to tell this story. And I think it comes across in the movie as well.
Thank you.
Well, this interview is sponsored by Navigating Hollywood, which helps people who work in entertainment to lead relationally and spiritually holistic lives. Navigating Hollywood offers courses for pre-marriage and marriage, and the Alpha Course that gives entertainment professionals the chance to explore the big questions of life. You can find out more at navigatinghollywood.org. And if you use the invitation code podcast, the courses are all complimentary. You can also sign up to get updates on the site as well. When your teenage character first arrives in Philly to live with his father, the neighbor across the street mentions that he hasn't eaten the pig slop yet. For people who don't understand or, you know, not familiar with the prodigal son story that she references, what were you trying to convey in that moment?
He hadn't hit his bottom yet.
Bad news before it's good news, right? And part of the bad news is coming to the end of yourself. And in that story, the prodigal son, when he's eating the pig slop and recognizing how far he'd fallen, so to speak, there's a moment of recognition that made his eyes kind of finally look up and say, what am I doing? I think what that messy character is essentially trying to explain to him is that there's no shortcut to growth and transformation. So you have not eaten pig slop yet. You have not hit your bottom. You've not come to the end of yourself.
Was there a moment in your lives where you felt like you got to the point of eating the pig slop?
Oh man, how many times have I eaten pig slop?
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. It's almost more like there's moments that you can signify in your life where you have recognized the harm of your own pride, selfishness, and desire to make yourself king, so to speak. But I also think the pig slop journey feels like a daily one too. like that's not necessarily like you eat it one time and then you turn from it, and then perfection is the next step. That journey of recognizing, you know, you're hitting a wall of your own making is a daily one, at least for me.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's why the only thing I feel like I can almost even teach my kids is how to repent and confess and seek forgiveness well, because they're going to constantly seek the slop, so to speak. Like, we just can't help ourselves. We're just so broken. I feel like as a people group, we try to pretend that we're not broken, or that we can achieve some level of like manufactured wholeness or success, but we can't. Like, it's just impossible. Obviously, in my worldview, that's why I feel like I need a savior, because I'm well aware the longer I live, the more I seek the pig slop or the brokenness. I'm aware of it. It's just being able to come to terms with that more quickly versus ignoring it.
And for you, Ricky, was there a certain moment of revelation for you that you needed something outside of yourself?
It's been certainly an evolution, but I think that time in Philly was most formulated and most for me. I think previous to meeting Will and actually engaging scripture myself, my faith actually wasn't necessary for my survival. I was more ignorant to like other people's hurting and suffering. I think it's, in my opinion, why Jesus says, I came for the poor, and that's where you should go. Because when you engage in other people's suffering, or because if you aren't gifted with your own suffering, it is where the Lord is met. And not that it can't happen in success or good times flowing, but I've never experienced that. It's only through when I engaged in a relationship with like this guy, Will, and it started to meditate on my own losses and his loss, and then, you know, loving him like a brother and being like, this is wrong. And then others that came after him, the gospel became actually necessary for my survival. That was a big changer for me. And then obviously since then, things have happened in my life that, whether it's losing E or other painful events, that help put greater things in context to like, why I'm alive, what am I doing here? And that there's a real beautiful gift that you have when you recognize that you can actually offer healing and wholeness, like essentially the kingdom of God, to people now. It's not something you just get when you die. It's actually like Jesus calls us to usher it into reality now. And like, we can be his hands and feet, all these cliche terms. They actually started to make sense to me when I participated.
In times of suffering, I think what becomes so clear is that all the things on this earth that we worship that are not God can't take on the weight of that worship. They crumble, they break, they betray you. Even relationships, like there's nothing that can hold that weight. So I think there's a helplessness in suffering that is actually merciful, because it requires you then to look for something that won't break, that won't decay, that is eternal. And I think when I was going through severe loss, I was finally able to clear all that out and just look at God for the first time clearly, because he was the only thing, you know, his presence was the only thing that felt real and felt like it could handle that weight.
You've worked with incarcerated people and Hollywood people. What would you say are the similarities or differences that you've seen between those two groups?
I don't know if there are differences.
No, I mean, I think, yeah, the similarities are as varied as human beings are varied, right? But I think like a desire for purpose, desire for meaning, a deep desire for opportunity for themselves and for their children and their children's children, the desire to leave something behind them. I think the differences are not necessarily anything to do with the individuals. I think the differences are normally circumstantial.
Yeah, it has nothing to do with their incarceration or lack of incarceration. Outside of that period of incarceration, they have all the same hope and dreams as you do, maybe in different forms, but they have hopes and dreams. there's just a lot of things blocking those from becoming to fruition that shouldn't necessarily be there. You can look at two people on a set that have the same amount of skills or desires, but one is just handicapped because our society has set them up to fail.
There's a really touching moment in the movie when a character who is paralyzed rode a horse for the first time. And I really teared up at that moment, particularly because I felt like it captured what you're doing, that you are giving people who feel paralyzed in their lives because of their circumstances an opportunity to do something that would feel impossible otherwise. That was a really great moment in the film. And I love that that just reflects what your passion is every day.
I appreciate that.
That's really cool. Certainly, given the context of what we've just been talking about, we are obviously attracted to stories that are rooted in transformation. I mean, I think all good narratives have that to a certain degree, but I think we are not afraid to dive into characters and community situations that are complex and compromised and live in that tension that Ricky talked about between light and darkness and choices that lead either way. Part of the story with Concrete Cowboy is we're all influenced by the presence or absence of our father. And I think that from an earthly father standpoint and a heavenly father standpoint. And so it was fascinating to be involved in a story that isn't just about the absence and isn't just about the presence. You get to see, in some sense, both sides of that coin. We're, at our hearts, optimists, but we're also realists to the struggle of being human and the reality of difficulties and death and loss. And so we gravitate towards stories that include both.
And just taking darkness and showing how beautiful it can be. I think we live in a world that wants to avoid pain, or like we want to raise kids like they're never going to have to experience conflict. Yet that is not the world we live in.
Now, for someone who's listening, who's inspired to help the incarcerated, what would be a good next step for them?
Names and faces. Meet people who are incarcerated, who have been incarcerated. The longstanding passion will come out of that. I also think if there's people listening that are at companies, positions of leadership at a company, and they have a desire after listening to this to maybe have their company or them be involved in providing opportunities for the formerly incarcerated, I'd really encourage them to reach out to Ricky and I. We've done that a lot with other companies. I think we can kind of dispel some of the fears, kind of passionately lay out kind of how we approach it and give some real helpful tools on how to do it so it doesn't feel overwhelming and it's just, you know, kind of one step at a time. So if there's anyone that's like that, would love to hear from them and happy to chat.
And how do they get in touch with you?
You can go on our Neighborhood Film Company website.
Great. Okay. And we'll include the link to that in the show notes as well.
Great.
Well, thank you so much for being with us today, Ricky and Dan. Really appreciate hearing your stories, your passion for telling stories, and your heart for helping others. Very inspiring.
Thanks for having us.
Yes, absolutely. And thank you to all of you who have joined us. Be sure to check out Concrete Cowboy on Netflix. And we'll include a link to their short, The Cage, in the links as well. If you work in entertainment, be sure to look at the courses that are available at navigatinghollywood.org. And again, use the word podcast to register for a complimentary course. Please follow us and leave us a review so others can discover this podcast. You can find our other shows, transcripts, and links to anything we talked about here and more at navigatinghollywood.org. I look forward to being with you next time.